Professor Peter Katzenstein. This is not meant as disrespect to Peter. This is meant as respect to Peter. I've been reading Peter's work for 25 years now. Long ago when I was a young aspiring academic, and for me I think his work has been some of the most important and inspirational in political science, international relations, comparative politics, particularly international political economy, over the last several decades. I can't think of any of the courses that you would have been doing, comparative politics, international relations, East Asian studies, where you will not have come across his work. In all of these fields, he's made a seminal contribution. He's currently president of the American Political Science Association, and for many years has been the Walter Carpenter Professor of Political Science at Cornell University. I think apart from his outstanding scholarship, I think the other singular contribution, or another singular contribution of Peter Katzenstein, is that there is a whole generation of eminent political scientists around the world to whom Peter has been PhD supervisor and or mentor in a whole host of ways. His contribution to the discipline is that's not just as a scholar, but basically he could basically, I think, fill three or four decent political science departments with his PhD students over the last several decades too. So for me it's a personal pleasure, and for all of us I know it will be an intellectual pleasure to have him speak to us. He's been working for quite a while, I know, on this project on the US and the world in different guises, including a book, was it 2 years ago, on anti-Americanism with Robert Cahane. So I'm sure you have something interesting to say to us. Professor Katzenstein will talk for about 30-35 minutes, and then we'll have time for comment and discussion. So let me, Peter, invite you to welcome you back to Warwick, because this is your second time here, and invite you to speak to us. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Richard. Thank you very much for coming. I know that you're in the middle of exam period, and I hope you're not having an exam, but that you're finished, so that the nodding off will be quiet and resourceful. Okay. While you nod, I'm talking today about a project which every APSA president is supposed to do in the last decade or so, which is to talk not to political scientists, but to talk to the interested public. And so there's a task force which I appointed, there was a topic which I chose, and most importantly, there was a task force leader with whom I'm working, Jeff LeGros. So what I'm preparing here, what presenting here today, is the draft report. We're sort of in the final stages, another 2 weeks or so we'll be done. And you know, it'll be presented to the political scientists, and then next fall, Jeff and I will sort of roll it out to various constituencies in the policy community. So that is really what this talk is about. The task force itself was about 20 people who volunteered their time, who came to three meetings, and each of them wrote about a 10-page memo that was sort of the entry prize for the meal. And there were three group leaders. Marty Finnemore headed the group on international organizations, Peter Trubowitz headed the group on American politics, and Jack Snyder headed the group on regions. And they carried a particular burden, of course, of coordinating this. So there's a widespread perception, not just in the United States, but around the world, that American standing has declined dramatically in the past decade. And Obama's charisma and his focused efforts to the contrary notwithstanding is unlikely to turn that tide. Now, standing matters for scholarship and policy. For scholarship in particular, while power remains constant, standing can vary. And that leads to interesting questions. Standing, it turned out, is very commonly used in public discourse in the United States, but virtually not at all among scholars. Scholars refer to terms like prestige, reputation, credibility, moral stature, authority, or legitimacy. In the world of policy, standing also matters. Paul Wolfowitz, for example, a fellow Cornellian from 40 years ago, in the 1992 Defense Planning Guidance, wrote basically that the United States needed to establish a stature so as to convince potential competitors that they need not aspire to a greater role. This was really addressed to the Japanese and the Germans. When he said stature, he sort of meant what we mean by standing. And one of Obama's central foreign policy objectives in the standard line in his stump speech was restore American standing. So standing matters politically. Here's the results of a poll from summer 2008. Improving America's standing in the world, 83%. That is the most important policy objective as the election heats up. Helping to bring a democratic form of government to other nations, 17%. That's the bottom part. Now, without the catastrophe in Iraq, that would have been higher. But still, it's not that standing is an unimportant political objective. And here is the main analytical distinction in the report. And I'll flag it now. I'll come back to it several times, but just in case you're tired. This is the distinction you should take, because it took us quite a while. But standing actually has two main components. It refers to credibility of the U.S. government, and it refers to the esteem of the American polity. And it's very important to keep these two clearly in one's head. So standing varies over time. Here is a set of public opinion polls put together by Pierangelo Isernia in a book which I did with Bob Cohen on anti-Americanism, which is the only time series data which we really have since 1950. And you can see that it goes up and down. It goes down in particular during the Vietnam War, basically. And it goes down, then it shoots up towards the end of the Cold War. It goes down under Reagan, and then it drops precipitously under George Bush's presidency, 2001 onward. So there are variations over time. Here's what I want to do in the talk. Briefly talk about definitions and the relevance of the topic. Then basically talk about the three audiences which we focus on: regions and countries, international organizations, and the United States. And finally conclude briefly in this audience with a few policy conclusions. So what is standing? Standing is an attribute assigned to the United States by other actors, such as foreign leaders or people, international organizations, transnational groups, and American voters. It has both an absolute and a relative quality. The absolute would be that standing varies over time. It can be high or low. The relative one is that often standing is compared to that of other actors. So you might look at tracking America's standing compared to China and the EU. And relying on public opinion data, which are not perfect for this, but the best we have right now, in the most recent polls from 2009, Chinese and European Union standing is declining relative to America's. Not exactly what I would have expected. Standing has multiple facets. The two big ones which I focused on: credibility of the US government to do what it says it is going to do. That was basically the focus of 40 years of deterrence studies on nuclear weapons. And secondly, and that means really standing up. And the second meaning is esteem, or standing for America's image in international politics. Now, credibility and esteem often work in tandem, that is, they're mutually reinforcing, but we found out they can also work at cross purposes. And when they do, this raises very difficult issues for diplomacy. Now, how can we compare standing to other concepts? Here are a few. First, hard power. In terms of both credibility and esteem, standing is deeply interwoven with hard power. Because hard power, material capabilities, are attractive to and respected by others. Standing and capabilities, however, are not the same thing. U.S. standing may vary, as I will briefly show, even if U.S. hard power does not. That certainly was the story of the last 8-9 years. So since 2000, relative American power is virtually unchanged, but its standing has declined dramatically. Standing is not only affected by the capabilities, but also by how these capabilities are deployed. What about soft power? It refers to getting what you want through appeal rather than through coercion. This is Joe Nye's definition. Standing is distinct from soft power in three different ways. First, and most importantly, it is not something a country has, but what others bestow upon it. It's something which is given to you. It is indeed important to investigate whether standing does have an impact on foreign policy, for example, increase the influence. That is, you have to study that, you can't just assume it. Second, standing is not defined by influence, it is as important, and if standing is not defined by influence, you have to investigate that empirically. What about anti-Americanism as a related concept? Standing is not about whether others are against the United States. Rather, it is whether they view the United States as a credible actor with traits that should be admired or emulated. So it's different from anti-Americanism. And finally, legitimacy. If we define it as conforming to recognized principles or accepted rules and standards, then it is distinct from standing. But legitimacy typically enhances standing. Adhering to certain principles may help or hurt a state's perceived position, but it is different from that position itself. And what do I mean by the U.S. in the title of this talk, U.S. standing? It means the U.S. government and its actions, that is referring to credibility, and it means the broader American polity and its character, that is what I refer to as esteem. So it is what the United States does and what America is. Both of those are implicated. So why does standing matter politically? For a variety of reasons. It shapes strategy. Leaders worry about it. States try to enhance their own and diminish that of their adversaries. Declines in standing make it harder to get things done. Any faculty meeting will tell you that. And increases in standing bolster foreign policy influences. So here I just want to give some examples to illustrate some of these ways. George Bush, for example, adopts after 9/11 a new national strategy. A policy package of assertive unilateralism, preventive use of force, and aggressive democratization. A very distinct change from the multilateral, reactive, and soft democratization policies of prior versions of Cold War internationalism. A very distinct change. Everybody recognized this is really something new and different. Now, this approach favored the credibility dimension of standing over the esteem one, but it soon lost most of its political support because of the disaster in Iraq, because of violations of international law, because it was resented by international public opinion, and because it was largely perceived to be ill-guided. So after 2005, the Bush policy in many spheres of politics reverses because of the erosion of standing. It was the erosion of standing which pressed Bush to change his policy. Think about Jack Kennedy. He worried over standing. He was an exceptionally heavy consumer of USIA multinational surveys, viewing them as early warning systems on international perception of the United States and its policies. Dwight Eisenhower also worried about standing, but he didn't worry about the international implications, he worried about the domestic ones. The decision to enforce Brown versus Board in Little Rock in 1957 was in part, not totally, but was in part supported by Eisenhower's sense that if racism didn't end, institutionalized racism in the United States didn't end, it would be a disaster for American standing in the Third World. Jimmy Carter's decision to seek ratification of the Panama Canal was due to concern about American standing, moral standing in particular, and he paid a very heavy domestic price for that. In many ways, that was the beginning of the end of the Carter presidency. And then Ronald Reagan, of course, his entire election campaign in 1980 was organized around the perception that American standing in terms of credibility had declined under Carter. So these are examples to show you that standing matters, that indeed it is the everyday currency of America's existence in the world. Political standing is like long-term political capital or something like goodwill in accounting. So let me then turn to the second part of the talk, which is about these three audiences. And the first audience are these regions and countries. The recent downturn, as these data show, has been uneven across regions, and if we had more time, we would say also uneven across nations within regions and across issues. It's been most pronounced in the Middle East and in Europe. It is strong in Latin America and Southeast Asia, and it's least noticeable in Africa and Southeast Asia. Now, why is that? Standing differs among elites and mass publics. For elites, standing is affected by the perception of U.S. policy on helping or harming elite interests. They have a very clear sense of what's good for them. For the general public, standing is affected by perceptions on the justness or the morality of American conduct in world affairs. Now, there is a frequent disjuncture between elites and publics. Let's think about the Middle East and Europe, where standing declined most. In the Middle East, authoritarian regimes often quietly are much more supportive of American policy than they can say in public. Mass publics, on the other hand, are often extremely critical because that criticism is also a political indictment of their own regimes. They catch, so to speak, not only the United States, but also their repressive regimes. American policies produce, therefore, diametrically opposed results at government and popular levels. And it's extremely difficult to fashion a diplomatic initiative which doesn't offend one or the other of these two constituencies. In Europe, on the other hand, democratically elected governments, by and large, express the sentiments of their mass publics. And if there are divergences, salient issues, this will become a salient issue in the next election campaign. In Latin America and in Southeast Asia, where there was less decline, and in East Asia and Africa, where it's basically unchanged, the gap between elites and mass publics is politically much less relevant at this time. By the way, it is interesting to note, and something which surprised us, that regime type does not seem to matter for standing. The erosion of American standing is greatest in the least democratic region in the world, the Middle East, and in the most democratic one, in Europe. Now, standing in different world regions has different meanings, and this is hardly a surprise, because political priorities differ, because there are different regional threats, and because there are different degrees of regional integration and identity, and because the relationships to the United States differ across regions. So standing should of course mean different things. In the Middle East, for example, since 2002, standing has meant democratization, and that threatened authoritarian regimes. And the perceived U.S. disengagement from the Israeli-Palestinian conflict hurt U.S. standing both with elites and mass publics. In East Asia, by contrast, the continued availability of American export markets enjoyed strong support among both elites and mass publics. Even though, as we now know, this availability of export markets led basically to a toxic economic crisis. Now, the second observation about the different meaning of standing in different world regions is it seems to matter a great deal whether there is a regional power in that region. If there is a major regional power, as there was in Cold War Europe with the Soviet Union, and as there might be potentially and not entirely benign China in East Asia, this will help American standing. Iran in the Middle East also helps American standing, particularly with some Sunni states. And the reason for that is that the devil next door is always the bad, worse than the devil across the water. Okay. Now, where there is no major regional power, as traditionally was true in Latin America, this is beginning slightly to change with the rise of Brazil, this will hurt American standing. Where you don't have regional powers in Africa, at least you have the memory of European colonial rule. And that gives America some standing. If you have the French to hate, you don't have to hate the Americans quite as much. Now, what might happen in the future? Is there a possible bounce back for America's standing in the world, given that it has declined so much over the last decade? In the Middle East, we think it depends enormously on the diplomacy, which Obama is now starting, the diplomatic initiative, on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and of course on the brooding crisis with Iran. And given how complicated that terrain is with this Israeli government, despite Obama's very recent, very even-handed remarks, I personally am pretty pessimistic. In South Asia, American standing will depend enormously on its successful management of very contradictory regional pressures in Sri Lanka, in Pakistan, in India, and between the relationship between Pakistan and India and Sri Lanka. In East Asia, it's quite clear that American standing hangs on policy success with the economic and security issues in the current crisis. The crisis being both economic and now, of course, with North Korea. To the extent that America will continue or increase its provision of regional public goods, the erosion of American standing will not occur. And in Africa, I think American standing will be affected by the size of the aid budget in a time of skyrocketing budget deficits. It's very likely that the aid budget will be cut, and that will hurt in Africa. So on balance today, it's too early to tell whether changing the course of American foreign policy, which I think Obama has really initiated, and in that sense is living up to his campaign promises, will be enough to reverse the sharp recent decline in standing. And my hunch will be it will be a very mixed record. Now, the second audience are international organizations. And here we mean international organizations broadly defined as both formal international organizations, law, global civil society. Standing is essential for the United States to exercise a leadership role. How has the United States been viewed, as one example, in the General Assembly? Here, data from 1945 to 2009. Now, it's hard to see all these colored lines. Look at the two bottom ones, the flat ones. Those are measures of relative capabilities, power. They basically haven't changed much since 1975. They changed before somewhat because of the reconstruction of East Asia and Western Europe after 1945. The other ones refer to various regions, and they all sort of chart a fairly dramatic decline over the last 40 or 50 years. Here's some important surprising facts. The agreement between the United States and Latin America, Africa, Middle East, and Asian countries is down about by 50% over this past decade. More interestingly, absolute levels of agreement between the average countries in those regions and the United States is now below the level of agreement between America and the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War. That is a surprising finding. I wouldn't have expected that, but it's true. Agreement with the United States increased significantly with the end of the Cold War in the late 1980s. There was a vision articulated then of a collaborative world where the U.S.'s new relative power would be used to jointly agree dance. But that agreement ended, not with the Bush presidency, as people on the left always like to think, but with the Clinton presidency, around 1996, when the United States was arguably turning more unilateralist in its policy. It was pressuring the Europeans during the Balkan crisis. The United States and NATO bombed Yugoslavia during the Bosnian and Kosovo wars. It refused the payment of United Nations dues and defeated the ratification of the Chemical Test Ban Treaty. Then, under Bush, there was a further intensification of unilateral policy, which leads to a further drop. But it's very important to notice it's the Clinton administration where it starts. You cannot simply say, oh, it's due to the Republicans, which is of what Democrats have always argued. Now, various country rankings by both intergovernmental organizations and NGOs produce roughly similar results. Here are two examples. The Press Freedom Index, which is basically constructed by Reporters Without Borders, has the United States standing diminished from number 17 in 2002 to number 36 in 2008. This, by the way, is not a statistic which you will find in the New York Times or the Washington Post. And it shares that spot now with Bosnia, South Africa, Spain, and Taiwan. Even on issues like development aid, where the United States, under the Bush administration, has committed substantially more resources than before, it does poorly in the Center for Global Development's Commitment to Development Index. The United States ranks 19 out of 22. So what are the sources of standing in decline? What are the sources of decline in standing? We think it has something to do with the gradual dispersal of U.S. power in the international system. The growth in the number of countries in the United Nations over the last 50, 60 years and the rise of more diverse and different interests than those of the United States. These past weeks and months, it's very interesting to focus on the change from the G8 to the G20. Here we have, in miniature form, this process of dispersal happening. And it's quite clear that American influence in the G20 will be diminished compared to the G8. Secondly, there is a growing sense that Washington is no longer the team player it once was. Now, whether that is true or not is another matter. The perception exists. And it has something to do, I think, with the turn towards unilateralism, both under Bush and under Clinton. And finally, there is a belief that Americans are not as deeply committed to providing the international public goods as they did during the Cold War. The representative from Papua New Guinea, sort of basically at an international meeting said a couple of years ago, either lead or get out of the way. And it was said with frustration, and to cheering applause. So it was crystallizing, I think, the sense of you are not doing what you used to do, therefore get out of the way. Let me then turn to the third audience, America. Now, this was sort of a surprise to my colleagues that I would include America in this task force, but I can't believe that one would want to talk about American standing without looking at the domestic basis, because the president needs to be elected at home. Here's the American satisfaction with the U.S. position in the world. Americans are clearly unhappy about how the country's standing has declined abroad. In the spring 2009 Gallup poll, that is after Obama's election, only 30% are satisfied with the U.S. global position, which is exactly the same number as when President Bush was president. So despite the optimism about Obama's presidency, the assessment about where we are in terms of standing has not changed. Public confidence in how the rest of the world sees the United States declines from about 75% of those who believe the United States had a positive international image to just about 40% today. Now, the most important thing about this divide is it is highly partisan. That is probably the most robust finding in terms of data and also in terms of substance, because Americanists who study this don't look at standing, and this was sort of new for them. Republicans think of standing in terms of hard power and resolve, favoring the credibility side of standing. That's what it means to them. Democrats, like most Europeans, emphasize the ideas like legitimacy and moral standing that highlights esteem. And the partisan gap, which has always existed, has widened during the presidency of George Bush. And here are the data for the Republicans. All curves go down, but the Republican curve first goes up and then goes down more gradually. So the partisan divide precedes the Bush presidency, and it has somewhat narrowed since Obama has taken over. You can see how that blue line is beginning to kick up. And you also see that the blue line under Clinton in January 2000 was above the red line. So Democrats and Republicans' views on standing depend substantially on who controls the presidency. Democrat satisfaction with U.S. standing was high under Clinton, and now that a Democrat is in the White House, it is beginning to rise again. And I would predict that, within 6 months or so, it'll be higher than the Republican. By contrast, Republican satisfaction rose when Bush assumed the presidency, and it has fallen and will continue to fall under Obama. So the control of the White House is really what it's all about. Here are the similar data now going back to the 1958. And they basically illustrate the same thing. The pattern of partisan polarization has deepened over time, especially since the end of the Cold War. Partisan differences spiked in the first Clinton years, and they've increased again. That spike of partisanship has increased again during Bush's term in office. Now, how here's the same thing now broken up by different presidencies, you can see with the data, but it's the same as the previous slide. So the end of the Cold War matters. Between the early 1950s and the mid-1970s, the Cold War has appeared to have a dampening effect on domestic partisan debate over foreign policy. Now, it's not true of the 1980s and the Second Cold War under Reagan. There, the partisan divide increases and Whether that is due to international developments is still one of our unresolved questions. Finally, the end of the Cold War, 1989-91, then leads to an evolving polarization of the electorate. So when the United States does not face a major geopolitical challenger, we should expect partisan and intergroup politics over standing to intensify. Here is a set of data which Matt Baum from Harvard sort of culled out of a 2004 Gallup poll, and it shows quite clearly the inverse relationship between the domestic job approval of the president and satisfaction with standing abroad. A president who enjoys high job approval, voters will think, will be satisfied with international standing. When the president has low job approval, they will be dissatisfied with international standing. What are the relationships between these three audiences? And we have some conjectures, they're not findings because the data aren't good enough. Conjectures. The first one is the consistency and the distinction between the two main aspects of standing, credibility and esteem. They crop up in the abstract conceptual discussion in various literatures in international relations. They crop up systematically in the different notions which elites and mass publics have about standing in different regions in the world, and they crop up in the different understandings of the concept of standing between Republicans and Democrats. A second conjecture is that the meaning of the concept of standing is not immutably fixed as either one or the other, as either credibility or esteem. Instead, it varies across time and space. During the Cold War, for example, U.S. standing varied enormously among the Soviet Union, the People's Republic of China, and Third World governments. Today, similarly, U.S. standing differs significantly among Muslims in West Africa, the Gulf region, and Southeast Asia. And of course, it varies in Western and Eastern Europe, and even among Canadians and Mexicans. In the 1960s, American Democrats criticized Eisenhower for failing to maintain reputation. That is, he was worried about esteem and race, not about credibility. And the same argument was made by Ronald Reagan and the Republicans against President Carter in the late 1970s. Carter was perceived to be weak. So Republicans and Democrats shift around in what they mean, how they understand the concept of standing. The third finding is the potential importance, third conjecture, is the potential importance of transnational political coalitions. When like-minded governments come to power in close proximity in time, as did Reagan, Thatcher, and Kohl in the early 1980s, or Clinton, Blair, and Schroeder in the mid to late 1990s, American standing receives a boost. There is sort of a sense that there is a new current in politics, and the United States is part of it. The election of conservative governments in Germany, Merkel in 2005 and Sarkozy in 2007, was seen by some Republicans as an indicator that the decline in American standing in Europe had come to an end. But the evidence on this point remains decidedly mixed. A fourth conjecture is the possible resonance of Republican and Democratic notions of standing in different world regions. Today's Democrats' concerns about legitimacy and esteem parallels the concerns of most European publics. While the Republican worries about deterrence and reputation and credibility and resolve seem much closer to the views held by elites and mass publics in East Asia. It is less clear how this distribution of opinion profiles works itself out in the Middle East because of the split between elites and mass publics, and in Latin America because of the possible conflation of the American role as a regional and a superpower. And here's finally one conjecture which we are still debating. Remember that I said during the Cold War there was sort of a polarization was attenuated. And at the end of the Cold War, polarization explodes. That leaves the anomaly of the 1980s. You had a second Cold War and Ronald Reagan, and partisanship and polarization increased, even though there was international competition and pressure. And so one possibility of thinking about this is that it is conceivable that actually standing activates in the United States and in the world differentially different attitudes towards the legitimacy of military force. And that we are dealing here with a phenomenon which actually is of a broader cultural type. This is, as I say, not a finding, it is a conjecture, but it is one we'd like to put on the table. So, here are five policy conclusions, very briefly. Standing is not a peripheral or unimportant issue. It's not that it's the only issue. There are situations where you should forget about standing and worry about other things. But we think that too often it's not given proper due in the mixture of considerations which influence policy. Secondly, standing means moving beyond conventional public diplomacy. Public diplomacy in the last decade has meant basically getting in the spin cycle of the news media. That is, using electoral strategy of electoral politics for foreign policy. We think this is not effective because any news originating from the United States, if America has low standing, will be discounted anyhow. It will be much more advantageous, we think, to use the decentralized transnational activities of American groups, possibly through the clever use of the tax code, in order to project different images of the United States. Thirdly, easily said but difficult to do, use different tools for different jobs. Don't think about, you know, one instrument will solve this. But this is very easily said, very difficult to do. Fourthly, don't forget about that close bond between hard power and standing. We think it would be a mistake to just say, oh yes, standing is nice and soft and fuzzy. Standing works in part because the United States has hard power. And finally, not surprisingly, since the report is written by professors, support data and research. Now, I hope to have convinced you that American standing in the world is an important political issue, that it is complex, and that it is difficult to measure. The United States needs to nurture credibility and esteem, the twin foundation of how the world regards the United States. And U.S. standing is part and parcel of who we as Americans are and what the U.S. government does. Our collective sense of self, our goals, values, interests, and dreams, helps to shape expectations that lead to judgments of our actions and that form, and this is as important, the basis for America's standing, our own self-respect. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have a good length of time for comments, questions. Keep them reasonably brief. Introduce yourself if you want when you speak. So, one there.
Hi, Lewis Harrington, master's student in international security. You suggested that under Bush, the standing of the US was different to, say, Clinton or Obama, certainly different to any other period, really, perhaps weakened. Now, taking into account the recent North Korean nuclear tests and in light of Iranian persistence in refining uranium, can we say that the standing really has a quantifiable impact on international peace and security?
So, which definition of standing, which of the two would you activate in order to think about the North Korean crisis?
I suppose the credibility, perhaps, because, you know, I think perhaps under North Korea, under Bush, there was perhaps more fear of North Korea that if they did something, there would be retaliation.
Right.
And now under Bush, under Obama, it's a case of actually they're not going to react.
And we don't know about the domestic politics in North Korea, what it is, but it's clearly a testing of resolve, which Iran is watching. And it's clearly a way of getting the attention of the Obama administration. They're preoccupied with Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the Middle East. And North Korea said, hey, what about us? Right? So it's the credibility is really for Obama. You know, and everybody has said, you know, during the campaign, he's inexperienced, he will be tested early. Now, whether this is the test, we don't know. And it's not quite clear, you know, whether how the South Koreans and the Americans are going to respond. Will they impose a blockade? That's basically the question. And North Korea is saying, you impose a blockade, that's war. Now, we'll watch it, right? Now, I think this is a crisis. The Iran thing doesn't, it's too protective. And a crisis has a sort of an element of time boundedness to it, right? And my hunch is that China is and Russia will be very active in saying, well, we got a lot of measures already on the books which we are not enforcing. Let's do that first before the blockade. And the Republicans will say, failed the first test. He didn't show resolve. Right? I'm not sure what he's going to do about that. So, but so it would be, yes, it will affect standing in the credibility sense, not in the esteem sense, because international opinion is quite united and say, the North Koreans are really crazy on this. Right? Why are they doing this? Right? I don't think the North Koreans are crazy. I think they're playing a diplomatic game of saying, we need attention too. Right? It's very rational. But the means by which they're doing it is highly unconventional. But anyway, I think it's a credibility dimension that's directly involved.
Matt McDonald. I guess this relates to the first or second, I think, of your policy recommendations about recognising the central role of standing in conceptions of the national interest. And I mean, I guess that hints at the idea that American policymakers aren't as conscious of it as they should be, or as I'm operating the way that consistently advances that. I guess two questions related to that. One, do you see standing a concern with standing operating at the level of a conscious concern with the promotion of an idea of American credibility or esteem, or does it operate at a more subconscious level for policymakers or indeed for the population? And secondly, is there a core tension that means that it's always going to be difficult to have a conception of standing as central to the national interest if there is this split, almost a dichotomy, as it would seem, between esteem on the one hand and credibility on the other, where I could see, you know, the Bush administration certainly represented elements of the fight in the war on terror as being about resolve and the maintenance of resolve in the face of this.
Right, so you can see on the war on terror how divided the opinions are. Cheney says we are much more secure. Right? Obama says we are much less secure because you're recruiting many more potential terrorists now than you did before. Why? Because of your policies. Right? So nobody knows who's right on this. Right? But it seems to be true if you think about American business, very much short term, right, or quarterly returns on capital. That's what drives it. And many foreign business, and this is somewhat crazy, that's driven by the reporting requirements of the investment house on Wall Street. Why do you think more long term? Right? And in policy making, the short term, the immediate, always has more, always needs help. A friend of mine, Steve Krasner, you know, was head of policy planning in the State Department, and you know, his story is a lousy memo coming in on time at 3 o'clock. It's a great memo coming in at 3:30 any day of the week. That's how Paul is made. Under enormous time pressure with very short perspectives. So what we are saying is there ought to be, we are not saying standing ought to override security interests. Not at all. We are saying standing needs to be put into the mix. You have to be aware that you are giving up something. And that may well be the right thing, but you can't just not neglect it. And often I think it's just not a consideration. And then there are situations in which you would want to say, we are willing to pay a short-term price because we think the long-term cost is too great. I'm not a perfect example, but it gets in that direction. Bobby Kennedy, in the October 62 Cuban Missile Crisis, I just read all the times, that's what it was. And he said, we are not a country which wages great and poor. Although the chance the military saying we get 90 to 95%. President Kennedy said 90-95%, not good enough for me. Bobby Kennedy made a different argument. He didn't say, Kennedy might have said, we get 100%, let's do it. And Bobby Kennedy said, no, we are not doing that. That was the advice of the president. There was thinking long term. Mm-hmm. Right? At the most serious crisis which we had in the world. So I think, you know, this requires, of course, leadership, which is something which we didn't talk about, which we thought hard about. Should that be part of it? Because presidential leadership and standing are close together. And we decided against it because it is a document for public consumption. And we thought juggling two things is easier than juggling three things. So.
fourth, I think, point that you had, which, if I remember, was the link between power and standing.
Right.
And it seemed to me that there, possibly, there was an inverse relationship between the power and standing, especially this ERP or the superpower, and actual action. Because, to some extent, the power and standing of the United States is what people assume it is capable of doing. But to some extent, when it does things, it may show that it isn't as capable of achieving as much as people thought that it was going to be, and that would affect both credibility and esteem. After all, the two regions where, or at least one of the regions where that credibility and esteem seems to have gone down in South Asia, well, I can imagine that US action in Pakistan may well have had something to do with that, even though the United States clearly can kill a lot of people. The trouble is it can kill a lot of civilians as well. And the same is true for actions in Iraq as well. The superpower not quite as capable of imposing itself there as might have been assumed. So one of the paradoxes is that to increase power and standing, you might want to be less active because you let people think that you can do something, but you don't actually have to show, don't want to show it too often, because you don't want to take that too far either, because then you don't do anything and people think that you're afraid of dying.
Yeah, well, that's of course nice to answer. Niebuhr would approve of, right? I mean, the greatest power is the power of self-restraint. It's one which Rubin approved of as a secretary, right? When he was head of Goldman Sachs. He brought all his advisors together every morning at 7, reviewed all the evidence, and the last question was always, so what should we do? Nothing? Great. They said the chance of making a mistake are much greater in investing one than the chance of being correct. But it doesn't always work that way. Think of the Chinese in the bombing of the embassy in Yugoslavia. The Chinese were fully convinced, well, of course they can target the bomb so that it goes into their shaft there and blows up that part of the embassy, right? The fact that, in fact, it was misguided and misfired was simply not credible. They had built up American bombing precision and position to that extent. So it's not always true. So if you don't do anything wrong, then you might actually become considered to be super powerful. So the inefficacy of deployment of force, as I said, it was capabilities and how the capabilities of the force. And actually the deployment part of it comes down to leadership and capacity. So it's not totally clear to me that's right, but often I think it is right. In general, my personal philosophy is certainly the Rubin one. Sit tight. Because you more likely create unintended consequences by rash action, which you cannot foresee, which is a lot of people in the US and in Europe said about Iraq. Virtually everybody in the Middle East said, right? So I think that's a good point.
Trevor McCriskin, the Pew Research World Attitude Survey, which is one of the things that you used here, obviously did show very clearly that standing fell across the period of the last sort of 10 years or so. But there was an interesting characteristic within that the objections seemed to be largely toward policy and forms of leadership under Bush, while there was a maintenance, even in regions where that level of standing fell away, a kind of maintenance of positive feelings about Americans as people and about American culture and even about American business practices, actually. And I wonder if any of that comes into the research that you've been doing and what role it plays in perhaps a strategy of the Obama administration to try to recover the standing of the US, if they can draw on that
right
will.
I looked at these polls very carefully when I looked at work on Anti-Americanism. And that leads to sort of one note about data. I think public opinion data are pretty flawed as indicators of standing. We rely on them largely because we don't have alternative measures now. So one of the things is that if you wanted to fund research, and realistically, you can't ask for millions of dollars, how would you get empirical measures of standing? I think it's through media analysis. And in particular, the medium which is not controlled by the press, and which is costless, and which is exploding every day in terms of numbers. And you can all study it. That's the web. You're vastly underutilizing chat rooms, things sort of spontaneous formation of it. There you could actually do, you quantitative content analysis to do this. So, if you gave me 40 fellowships for doctoral students working around the United States on this, you could build up a database which would be considerably better, I think, than the Pew polls do. But it is true that, you know, Americans in after Bush took over didn't have really to travel with the Canadian flag on the backpack. Because it was not, there was a very clear distinction in foreign perceptions about United States policy and the American polity. That's very robust. And especially in the Middle East, you know, publics are enormously discerning about different aspects of America. You go to assessment of American higher education, technology, and research, 60 to 70% approval rates. You go to assessments of American foreign policy, 2% approval rates. Right? So it's not that sort of the demonization of America with God. Foreign publics are extremely sophisticated publics. And of course, they have a very sane attitude, and they're skeptical. So I think it's a robust finding. I think it has something to do with the esteem versus credibility dimension. But the data themselves are about opinions of individuals. They are not about intersubjective understandings which are bestowed upon the United States. So there is sort of a distance between the indicator and the concept. But it was the best we had, so we had to do it.
Nicola.
Nicola Pratt.
Hi, Nicola. We met a long time ago.
In your presentation, I think what you alluded to is the significance of the end of the Cold War on the changes in US standing globally. But that seems to me that one of the conclusions might be that the problem lies in the nature of post-Cold War era and the need to strengthen, I think, global institutions, international law, maybe reform of the UN, because a lot of the negative perceptions of US standing are related to the fact of actually negative perceptions of the way that the global system works, and the US obviously as the superpower that seems to control more or less how that system works, and that the, you know, perceptions of injustice, especially, well, I can talk about the Middle East since I know about that, and people do see it as an unfair global system.
Yeah, I think that's an element. I don't think it's the whole thing, because if it were, then the EU should be really riding sky high. But it isn't. The EU always pumps itself up as the normative power, and we are law-abiding, all of that. And a lot of it is empty. Empty rhetoric. And it's recognized as such. That is, the EU is very high on the esteem dimension and very low on the credibility dimension. And people realize it. So to the extent you're saying, well, you know, it's Bush warmongering Americans, I say, yeah, that's an element of it. But normative power mongering Europeans apparently get it on the chin too. It seems to be a balance between the two. And sometimes, you know, leadership actually does require doing things which aren't popular. That's part of it. Right? And so I think the centrality of power, hard power, close standing, should not be underestimated. Because otherwise it would all fall onto the esteem dimension. And I don't think that's true. If you talk to people in East Asia, they don't look at the world those terms. And I think people in the Middle East don't look at the world those terms. They surely like multilateralism. The Chinese do. Everybody does. They call it something different. But I don't think they think that that's what international politics is. I think that's part of international politics. And we've tried to capture that with these two concepts.
Paul.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you a bit more about how you conceived of the measure, as well as the split between credibility and esteem. Because at one point you said it has an absolute and a relative quality.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not entirely convinced by what's been said that it's not purely relative, particularly when you started talking about US standing held by the devil next door idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wondered whether you agree or disagree, if you could conceive of standing as a zero-sum game amongst all the participant countries. And so can you conceive of, say, two countries simultaneously having very high standing?
That's akin to saying we have lakeshore property, the lake is limited, right? And it's a positional good. Right? I think if you look at empirical measures, it, and we look quite carefully, it all depends on how you prime your subject for the question. Okay? And you get very different results depending on how you frame the question to them. So I think people, you know, we can say as international relations scholars, oh yes, we are thinking like Hobbesians, or we're thinking like economists, right? It's a world of relative gains. No, it's a world of absolute gains, which are conceptions which we have, which we actually don't quite know where they come from, but they're enshrined in these two disciplines. I think audiences of the kind which we describe will respond to standings how you prime them. I think they probably also have these preconceptions, and probably not quite as sharply edged as academics do, but they sort of have a sense about it. And it depends on how you activate situation with certain understanding. So you sound a bit like Hobbesian. Okay. Look at the lake and say it's a position of good. Of course, if you think the world is made up only of monopolists, this creates, for example, think about Latin America, where the United States is a regional power, global power, and Brazil is now rising. There seems to be sort of a duopoly of nature. Not just one or the other. And many people say this is happening in Europe. The French-German alliance, or the British-French alliance, or whatever, right, over the last 50 years. So the notion, certainly the dynamic between China and Japan, so the notion that can be only one, I think, is a very political science IR perception. I right now work on civilizations. Okay. Civilizational spaces, which we would say are sort of the big powers of China and India, you know, the West, maybe with two branches, they actually are spaces existing within what they call a global dominion. And that's really an interlacing of different kinds of civilizations. And if you look at an area like Southeast Asia, it's not clear that it's only India or only China. No, it was India and China, a little bit of Korea. And then, of course, a lot of indigenous material. It all came together in different forms. It's a different conception of politics. Right? So, but empirically, if you ask yourself, what do the data yield? I think it's very important to say, how were individuals primed? Which situational response did they think was most appropriate? And that came up very politically. You know, if you make it policy, you will have to have a sense of that.
Mark.
Mark Taylor, Warwick Business School. I wondered if you could say a little bit more about the relationship between standing, particularly in the esteem dimension, and the economic cycle, and whether what you see is, if anything, the fallout of the current crisis, the current recession, is for the U.S. standing.
I see it very clear. I mean, you see it very clear. The Financial Times is seeing it very clear.
Right.
It goes only in one direction. The Anglo-American model of capitalism is taking a big hit. I mean, my savings are down. I don't know about your savings. You're teaching a business school. Maybe yours are up. You know, right? Yours are up. Okay. Yeah. So smart rate. But most people say this didn't work out too well. Right. And now, you know, if you're an American, you think that Hank Paulson is the greatest of all robber barons we've ever had. I mean, there's no other way of describing this guy. Okay. That's widely perceived the way people have discussed the Cuba problem and other things. But the sums that Paulson stole are considerably larger than £40,000 or what. You're talking about $400 billion. That's not small change. So I think this is very wide perception. In Europe, in East Asia, certainly in China, they're very different about it. In Latin America, now to rebuild this will take time. So I think on the economic crisis, the data which we've seen in common sense says it's going to take a decade. It's one of the reasons why I say it's not kidding that Obama can reverse this. Because we actually don't know whether we are sort of in a lull right now, or whether the big bang of the collapse is still coming. Nobody knows. He doesn't either. So I think this has very dire implications.
Jim.
Thank you. Jim Shields. Going back, if I may, to the distinction, or rather the critical relationship between power and standing. You seem to be thinking clearly here of hard power. You've stressed hard power. not so much in Joseph Nye's distinction, soft power, and I wonder whether you could perhaps say a little bit about where standing sits in relation to both types of power.
Well, I tried to show at the beginning of the talk that it's different from soft power and that it's different from hard power. That was the most important thing. I ended the talk saying, don't forget, hard power is really important. And I can tell you, when I put together the task force, it would have been extremely easy to put together task force of American professors who all vote Democrat. I didn't do that. So I had 5 conservatives on the task force. I wished I had 7 or 8. But I couldn't find 7 or 8 that were really smart. That's a problem. But those 5 were really smart. And one in particular, Neil is on the first draft. That was Henry Now. Okay. Because Now would, in fact, like to get rid of the concept of standing and fold it into hard power. And I say, Henry, look at the chart. Hard power doesn't vary. Standing goes up and down a lot. This makes no sense. But it comes down to his saying, here's a bunch of liberals trying to knock the Bush administration. It's so partisan. It was partisan in our task force. I wanted it to be partisan. There's no avoiding of politics about this. This is not value-free social science. You look at data. But so Joe actually, you know, says, okay, here's soft power. Soft power is an attribute for Joe. It's what, this is very different from standing. And I just gave his legs at Oxford, and Joe was in the audience. He was a second reader on my dissertation. But he says the soft power I have gets magnified by the cultural resources, values, beliefs, whatever. And those cultural resources have a relational dimension to it. So they're actually stretching towards a sociological formulation. And that is more like standing. Right? I don't think you can get there, because it starts off with an atomistic view where actors have things, they have attributes. But his instinct, I think, is right. So the distinction, I think, between soft power and standing is fairly clear. It's a theoretical foundational one between economics and sociology. Economists think of actors who are big and small, dumb and smart, right? And they interact in markets. Sociologists don't think that. They think about relationships. Now, the relationship between hard power and standing, I think, as I said, almost any example which we were debating could be interpreted from both directions. But the Henry Nows of the Republicans of the world would look at it in terms of credibility. And where the Democrats would look at it in terms of esteem. And you have to come to reasoned judgment based on the evidence. And often the two are very close together. Just as hard power is very close to hegemony for Gramsci. Gramsci sort of articulates quite clearly.
Len.
Yeah. Honest aim and standing, I mean, I'm trying to think through Leighton Mass's and how they're separate here. And what's the relationship between, and it's the relationship between Americanization and standing. Because when Americanization as a phenomenon, I think you can see at the mass level quite clearly. So, I mean, I would think of hip hop and Beyonce here and also in Denmark and Sweden, you see kids wearing clothes and enjoying music that is
right.
American and Americanized. And I wonder then whether there's variation in how the elites in those countries communicate to the masses about America that informs standing.
Well, there's Americanization.
Yeah.
There's Europeanization. Mm-hmm. Right? Nicole just talked about that. That's sort of the spreading of good conduct. There's Sinicization. There's Indianization, Slumdog Millionaire, right? There is Islamicization, right? Very powerful, and not just how, I mean, there's whole consumer culture and all this. All of these are, of course, ways of spreading influence, and that's how typically big powers think. We are bringing Elvis Presley to the world. I mean, I remember when I grew up, you know, Elvis is becoming German. I love that headline, because he served in the army in Germany, right? And they put a crew cut on him, you know, and he hung up his guitar, and he was now German. Yeah. We made Elvis ours, which is what everybody does. You adopt what's coming from the outside, you appropriate it, right? Does it in the end, does that enhance American standing? Yes, I think it does. But it's a creative act. It's not cultural imperialism. The Coca-Colaization of the world turned out to be not the way it worked out. There was good cola 77 in India. They threw Coca-Cola out. Say, you don't want to share your trade secret with us? We'll make our own. By the way, it tasted awful. Okay. And Coca-Cola is back in India.
Yep.
Okay, 20 years later. So I think it is a process of diffusion, but importantly, it's a two-way process. So as GM goes under on June 1st, which is only two more days, this has a lot to do with Japanization. Japan remade Detroit. No, it took the automobile industry a good 40 years to know what scholars have told them since 1973. Well, you know, that's what happens to dinosaurs. They die out. So I think it's a two-way thing, and it does increase standing, but whether in fact some of these brands are still identified with nationality, that is an interesting empirical question, and it will vary. But these are important processes in a business school. You study this all the time, right? I mean, the brand of America, made of America, after the war, I tell you, American business invests heavily in studying the brand America, and then changes. You know, you introduce new software drinks in the Islamic countries. You're not marketing Coca-Cola any longer, you're marketing something else. Makes a lot of sense, you know. Quran Cola, I don't know what they called it.
David.
David Wilson, Business School, no savings.
Are you richer or poorer?
I'm not going to reveal that.
I married my wife with that vow, you know.
Just interested, your data is about associations between events and schisms and coming together and so on. And just building on an earlier question about the impact of the internet and media spin and individual reactions, I wondered if within your data set you could see how things like attributional power, I'm a sociologist, that attributional power could actually vary quite significantly pre and post the internet. In other words, that not just media spin but individual opinion can actually make things like attributional power really a fragile concept. Neither zero-sum nor relative, but actually incredibly fragile. Mm-hmm. And if I look at your data, that there seems to be some indication of that, that post the internet, and there's greater volatility, if I can use that word, between schisms and associations and so on. And I wondered if, A, you'd seen that in the data set, and B, whether you're continuing this research and looking forward, somebody like Obama going to have to pay very great attention to not just the impact of perceived power as we've understood it between nation states and between whatever geographical division of the world you put it, but into our economic division, but actually is due often to the opinions of new thought leaders who can get that information out into the world a lot faster actually than Coca-Cola were able to get Coke or Levi's or McDonald's out into the world.
I got a very clear answer to the second half of the question and a confession on the first. Obama is fully clued in. I can tell you that because if you watched his election campaign, it was astonishing. I'm getting emails now almost daily, okay, from the Obama affiliated groups. And that was one reason why the reach the youth vote so effectively, why the demographic shift towards Obama seems to be so dramatic. So he is in that sense the first politician we've had who is fully clued in, and the guy who develops the software from him is 23 years old. Right. So he understands that. And therefore, I don't think he'll say, oh yeah, centralized spin room in the State Department is the way to do it. I think that for him was striking out. That was a form of Stalinism. You know, can't do this better. Right. But the confession is what you refer to as data, we don't have. Task force works under the assumption of pulling together what we know in a framework of about 10 to 12 months. And we know astonishingly little. So there is very little. If you ask how did we make these assessments about regions, there were a few pre-calls, but basically you relied on the informed judgments of people who know the regions. The hardest data are the polarization data in American politics. On international organizations, that was hard to do, what Eric Whitten did for us, because we worked in the General Assembly. Well, I know there's one line. I mean, you've got to do this 20 times over. So one of the things with Legros and I have to think through now is, if we were to do this as a research project, we couldn't just say, oh, we're getting the 5 or 6 specialists together to put this together, because actually we would have to generate data, which, put it frankly, in international relations, doesn't normally happen. We feed off other people's data, right? Or copy from journalists. So that's the confession. But I don't feel apologetic about it. You know, we wanted to pull together something which is of direct policy relevance, and the standing, as the first graph showed, is. So in that appendix, you know, we got 15 topics and questions. And well, and many of them required getting the data. But yes, Obama understands this. That political machine is truly amazing.
You shouldn't encourage people from business schools or things like this. They always think that data is the plural of anecdote for scholars of international relations. Young lady at the back of the room.
Can you speak up just a little? I'll move up, but you've got to shower.
I'll come forward.
Okay, good.
Militaristic intervention in terms of strengthening U.S. ties. At first glance, it would seem that that whenever there has been militaristic intervention, for example, when Bush 1 intervened in the Gulf War, there was loss of legitimacy. Again, when Bush 2 came, there was a serious fall in the craft as well. Starting in 2001, the War of Terror began. 2003, the Iraq War. It just goes down every time there's militaristic intervention. But given that, you know that it's sort of a short-term display of power is necessary, while at the same time legitimacy is also necessary. So in strengthening U.S. standing, where would you place militaristic intervention in policy prescription, especially when you think of it in terms of a game theoretic sort of a model? It would prove quite problematic there.
You know, I was born in 1945. There's a Berlin blockade in 1948. Did it improve American standing among Germans or not? It did. Right. Quite clearly it did. If you go to Eastern Europe these days and ask about American standing and compare to American standing in Western Europe, it's much, much higher. And the most admired and respected political leader is Ronald Reagan. That cowboy. Sort of smells and talks like George Bush. They both acted, by the way. One was an actor, okay, Ronald Reagan. He sort of played a role. George Bush studied him very intently, and the whole Texas cowboy boot business is just an act. Right? Oh, I don't read books. I'm pretty dumb. You know, I'm ordinary Joe. Not at all. You know. His father was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. George Bush is very much a man of the elite. Right? So, I think it varies a great deal. When you're saying, well, but you know, George Bush in the war and every place standing was done. No, it didn't. Didn't go down in Africa. Didn't go down in East Asia. So it varies. That's the major finding we find. It varies a whole lot. Okay. But in general, I would say yes. And after 2001, 2002, because the Americans do something very dramatic, they change from a status quo to a revisionist or revolutionary power. That doesn't happen very often. When the most important power turns out to be revolutionary, everybody gets nervous. Right? So I think you're right for after 2002. Right? And when you want to understand why that is, you know, you have to say, understand what 2001 was about, which many Europeans don't. 2001 was a repetition of Pearl Harbor. I was in New York City when it happened. Okay? And I can tell you, within 5 minutes, I was in the Bell and TV room to see it. And it was a blue sky, and everybody said quietly to themselves, not accident, it's what the media said. They said Pearl Harbor. And for 50 years, America had a tripod of deterrent power saying, no more Pearl Harbors. The society was totally disoriented. And Bush, you know, who had no political rationale, no program, no whatsoever. You know, he was just put there by some political machine, like a dog back to one row. But I think it's important to say, if you look at the third slide and its regional variation, don't forget, it varies a lot. So it's easy in Europe, in Western Europe, to think about the world the way Democrats think about the world. And when I give this talk in the United States, I say, you know what? American standing takes a huge hit under Clinton. They scratch their head and say, oh, well, what is that? Well, it has to do with unilateralism, right? Which you're pointing to. It has to do with bombing and US bombing. So I think you're saying, yeah, these things. But Yugoslavia did not have a huge impact. It had a huge impact in China because of the embassy. But otherwise, it didn't have a huge impact in Southeast Asia and East Asia. The world is just so big. So we were surprised about how variegated and nuanced the findings are and the conclusions between the two draw. And we fought about them. I mean, we fought about them politically.
I can't see any more questions. Last question then. That's it.
I'm just making an assumption at the beginning and see if it makes sense. Given that those developing countries are emerging, that means their cultural standing, their cultural values will acquire new importance. So it means we're going to have more values. So don't you think then that the credibility side is gaining more predominance to the esteem side, because it's like, you know, you're going to have, it's like marketing, you're going to have different markets, so you can't target all the markets.
Mm-hmm.
So credibility is the only language probably that everyone understands. And the second point is, what's your opinion about the Afghanistan strategy? Because Afghanistan is the only place where credibility and esteem really go together, apart probably for the Taliban, they don't think so, but all the rest of the world probably thinks.
I think the first part, you know, we talked about a little when we said, you know, the world is becoming, we move from the G8 to the G20, or the world since 1950 becomes more diverse, therefore more different interests, and therefore this is structurally built in. I think this is true. Okay. But I wouldn't make it overly structuralist and say, therefore it's only credibility. For that, there's too much slack in the international system. So I think if you make policy, and we end up with policy, we're not writing, you know, like Mersheim and saying, here's one explanation, use my hammer for all nails, okay? That actually is not how policy is made. You, of course, confront situations where it's more or less relevant. Right? And so, but over the last 50 years, I think you're probably right. Which, of course, would affect any rising power, too, to the extent that the Japanese thought they were the anointed second global power for the 21st century. That the Chinese think so now, that the Indians are in the wing pumping themselves up, just as the Americans did 8 years ago. The new Rome, all those books about. Lasted less than Hitler's 1,000 years. You know, so I think the era of this sort of conception of running the world, every country apparently has to go through this for a little while. But the time period of going through it gets shorter and shorter because the world is no longer that way. Right? And we sort of know. So there was one. Now, what about Afghanistan? Afghanistan is an incredibly the potential Vietnam for Obama. It's an unwinnable war, that's for sure. So the optimistic explanation is the 20,000 he's putting in is not the beginning of an escalation strategy, but the beginning of an end. I think that's what he's aiming for. But it's easy getting trapped. So. Right now, I have a former student of mine, Ike Wilson, who was the first one who openly spoke up from the military, openly spoke up against the war, ended up there for teaching. He's going to Afghanistan to develop the army's new civil military strategy. That's an indication where the strategy is going. But somehow they'll have to get an arrangement with the Taliban. This is hard to do because the Taliban is not an actor. The Taliban is a very loose confederation of totally disparate political coalitions. And you have the national security issue, which is saying Al-Qaeda, we don't like too much. But it is, in the foreign policy, Afghanistan and Pakistan are the two most intractable problems he's going to face.
Thanks. The reason I was about to say I couldn't see any last questions is because I wanted to ask one, so I'm still going to ask it anyway. But
sure.
Peter, one of your last recommendations, and I took down the quote verbatim, was move beyond public diplomacy.
Right.
Use decentralized transnational groups. So how to do that? That's the question.
Well,
we have pretty good data, and there's data in the report about the role of foreign students. This is pretty robust in education research that if you bring people to the United States and let them see firsthand, they'll return on the whole with better opinions. Not always, but on the whole with pretty accurate and better opinions. Not better in the sense, oh, they're always pro-American. They see the dark side just as the light side. But on the whole, they're very effective ambassadors. Now, if you have in America, as I think you do, a highly polyvalent, that is, you know, you've got a Christian right, and you've got a progressive left, and you've got a lot of other things which are not politically quotable. It's sort of like a big supermarket. You can shop in America and find what you like and also find what you don't like. You like pornography? We got pornography. You like Catholic? We got Catholics. Okay. So the Christian right and pornography are, we export both of them. That's part of Americanization. If you, in fact, figured out a way of saying, well, which of these activities, you know, would lead to long-term improvement of standing, right? You say, okay, you guys, for your international activities of bringing visitors in, you know, we'll give you a tax break. It's not very expensive. You know. I financed my studies in America being an escort interpreter for the State Department. That was a pretty good job. That paid 1 year of college in 6 weeks. But it was the State Department identifying abroad in 30 or 40 countries, you know, the up-and-coming elite. My guy was a trade unionist, didn't speak a word of English. I had to get him up in the morning, I had to put him to bed at night, you know, I was with him the entire time. They arranged a study tour for 6 weeks, you know, and he went to Atlanta to see race relations, and he went to New York to see the crafts union, whatever he wanted to see. And it was a deliberate public diplomacy to get contacts with leaders of the future and to give them an exposure to America. It worked pretty well then. It would not work now. Just wouldn't. Right? So you would have to come up with alternative measures. You know, foreign students do this for us, but you know, there are other ways in which one could do it. And I think American society, given that the public opinion polls on Americans versus United States are so consistently positive, if you were to think about increasing standing, you want to invest in America, not in the U.S. government. U.S. government touches something, it's toxic.
Okay, thanks very much. I'm thinking of Paul Krugman's comment recently that the Chinese gave you toxic toys and you gave them toxic assets, which was an exercise in reciprocity. I should say, I went to the U.S. as a young postdoc on a Fulbright fellowship, and it changed my. Mm-hmm. I went there feeling essentially quite prickly and hostile,
mm-hmm.
and it changed my judgments on the nature of the U.S. entirely. So,
I never went back.
So, on everybody's behalf, I'd like to thank you very much for a very enlightening and entertaining hour and a half, which has gone very quickly, certainly for me and for everybody else, I suspect. So thank you very much indeed.
Thanks.
Thank you. Just a small question on the graph that you showed on how many times countries sided with the American and UN
General Assembly.
I was just wondering whether in your final graph you will include also the amount of resolutions that have been voted on.
No,
because I think that was something I personally was missing. Like, you see how many times they agree, but how many votes are there?
Because we've got to get this down to, this is 10,000 words report. Mm. The public version is 4,500.
Yeah.
So.
All right.
But there are enough footnotes in there that you can track it down.
Okay.
The work was done by Eric Fruten.
Mm.
Okay. So he didn't make it up.
No. I'm not saying that he made it up. I was just thinking that it would be actually even more interesting to see how many votes there were to see actually. Yeah. Because I assume that there are
quite a lot
more votes.
I don't know the answer to that, but I assume there are quite a lot.
I think.
How are you?
Fine. Good. How are you?
Good.
Thank you very much for your talk. It was really interesting. Is the report going to be available publicly?
Yeah, it'll be on the EFSA website.
Okay.
So I think they're going to print copies and we'll put it on the website.
Okay.
And there's a long version and a short version.
Okay. Great.
So all the graphs will be in the short version as well. Long version is too long.